It's good to be with you this afternoon, and I count it a privilege every time I get an opportunity to be able to come and share with folk like you. And I've had a bit of a connection, I suppose, with Seniors Getaway and Seniors Plus over the last couple of years. Maybe you're getting a little bit sick of me. If so, I apologise for that. But anyway, this afternoon, I've been asked to share on this topic this is the topic that we sort of eventually settled on, a personal journey through grief and loss. And I guess because grief and loss have been a fairly significant part of my own life, what this is going to turn out to be is a kind of testimony, an extended testimony. And then what I want to do is to try and draw some lessons that I believe that God has been teaching me over the years around this subject. And then, as Morris said, we'll open it up for some questions after that. I'm very aware that when we talk about a subject like this, that my experience may not be exactly the same as somebody else's experience. I think we're all wired a bit differently, and we're all going to grieve a little bit differently. Maybe there'll be some similarities, but I don't want to pretend that what I have gone through and how I have handled it is necessarily the way you ought to work your way through this as well too. But having said that, there may be some things that I say this afternoon that will be helpful to you, that will be an encouragement to you, maybe that might raise some questions in your own mind that you may want to work through at a personal level. Okay. Just a few quick facts about my early life. I was born and raised in Papua New Guinea. My mum and dad lived up there for nearly 30 years. We're involved in a lot of ministry there in Port Moresby. I grew up, obviously, in a Christian home. I came to know the Lord when I was about 10 years of age. I went to boarding school in Brisbane, studied at Queensland University, became a doctor. Ended up working in Bilawila. Anyone have ever been to Bilawila? Okay. Billow's the centre of the universe. We ended up living there for 21 years, and so a large part of our life is spent there in the country, and they were just wonderful, wonderful years. I met my wife there. I'm very thankful to the education department. She was a school teacher in Bilawila. We got married in Bilawila, and we started our family there. And in 1987, after 6 years of life in Bilawila, we said our goodbyes. We went to Bible college thinking that we were going to spend the rest of our lives in Africa doing medical mission work. So that was the trajectory we were on. That was the plan that we had in our minds. We did 2 years at Bible college, and then things took a bit of a U-turn. And instead of heading for Africa to do medical work, the church, the little Baptist church in Bilawila, invited me to go back there as their pastor. That was never part of our thinking or planning, but we went back there initially on a short-term basis just to help the church out and to spend a bit more time praying about our longer-term future. And what started off as 3 months became 6 months, and that was now 35 years ago. but we lived for another 13 years in Bilawila, and during that time I did a bit of medical work to help the other doctors in the town out. So I was mixing both medical and pastoral work for those 13 years. What happened is that our family grew to 6 children, 5 boys and a girl. And in the year 2000, when our lives were extremely busy and we're very involved in the work of the church there, Debbie discovered a lump in her breast. Our baby was only 13 months old at the time. She had just finished breastfeeding, and she was 41 years of age at that stage. And of course, immediately, we arranged for her to see a specialist in Rockhampton, and she had all the necessary investigations. And within a couple of days, she had a mastectomy, which then led on to 3 months of chemotherapy and then another couple of months of radium treatment down here in Brisbane. So our lives were kind of thrown into chaos because of that. It was never sort of something that we had expected or planned on. And it raised all sorts of issues and questions for us as a family. And of course, it threw us back on the Lord. At that time, even the day before she had her initial operation, we called the leaders of the church together following James 5. We anointed her with oil and we prayed very specifically that God would take control of the situation and that his will might be done in Debbie's life. Of course, whenever you get a cancer diagnosis, your life then becomes a merry-go-round of doctor's appointments, of scans, of blood tests. And, you know, if you've been in that situation, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. It becomes your way of life. And we entered into that way of life at that point in time. I say our way of life because we had kids that were in their upper teens by this stage. Oh, sorry, they weren't at that stage. They were a bit younger than that, mid-teens and lower down. But I mean, every time there's another blood test or another scan or something like that, the tension in the family rises because everybody wants to know what the results are showing and whether it's good news or whether it's bad news. And that was kind of the way that it was for us at that point. As well as that, when you live in a small country town and you're surrounded by a close-knit church family, everybody else wants to know what the results are showing and what the news is as well too. And Debbie used to say that when she'd go shopping down at Woolies in Billawela, that it would take her about three or four times as long in Billawela than when she came down here to Brisbane, because every second person is a personal friend and they all want to know, you know, how things are going. And that's very nice, actually, well, even if it does get a little bit wearing at times. At the end of the following year, after living in Billawela for 21 years, we felt that the time had come for us to conclude our ministry in Billawela and to move to Brisbane. And I accepted an invitation to be the senior pastor of the Gordon Park Baptist Church, which a couple of years later then became the City North Baptist Church when we relocated. For all of us in the family, it was a big change. And our oldest boy at that stage was heading into university, and the others were in their either high school or primary school years. And Debbie had homeschooled our children for 9 years when we lived in Billawela, and she loved doing that. She was a school teacher, and there was a reason that we chose to go down that track, which isn't relevant to this story here now. But we decided when we moved to Brisbane that we would put the kids into school and just take a bit of pressure off Debbie. But that only freed her up a little bit more to be involved in a lot of other ministry that she really loved to do. And she had her Bible study group and her children's ministry, and she was helping to set up a very effective women's conference that we used to run from the church there. And she threw herself wholeheartedly into ministry of the church. And I was very blessed to have her alongside of me in that work there. Of course, once we got to Brisbane, she had to hook into the medical system at the Royal Brisbane Hospital. I remember her distinctly giving me an article one day written by John Piper. At that stage, John Piper had been diagnosed with prostate cancer. And he wrote this article called Don't Waste Your Cancer. And Debbie used to sort of say, well, if I have to have cancer, you know, I want to use it for God. I don't want to waste this opportunity that God is giving me. And that was sort of the attitude that she had. And I remember she would go for her appointments at the Joyce Tweedle building at the Royal Brisbane Hospital there. And often she'd have to wait and wait and wait. And so she'd chat to the folk who are in the waiting room there. And one day she sort of thought, well, there's a magazine rack there and there are all these rubbishy magazines there. I'm going to bring some of my books along and put them in there. And she would get this book called If I Were God, I'd End All the Pain. And she'd write on the inside cover, this book belongs to the Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital. Please return, or something like that. And every time she'd go for an appointment, you know, she'd just check to see if the copies of this book had been, you know, had been used, whether they were well thumbed. If they disappeared completely, she would be praising the Lord. You know, someone's stolen it and taken it home, you know. But yeah, and then she'd have to spend days in the day hospital there, hooked up to a line and getting her chemotherapy and chatting to the other ladies around her. And ladies used to ring her up during the week and just check to see how she was going, or ask her questions, or just, you know, open up and share their hearts with her. I didn't know who these ladies were. You know, I just hand the phone over to Debbie and she would chat away to them. But she really wanted to make sure that she took the opportunities that God was giving her to make the most of her cancer. For most of the years after we moved to Brisbane, Debbie kept in pretty reasonable health, and I'm thankful for that. She was a very uncomplaining person. Interestingly, about every 2 or 3 years, the cancer would start to escape and get away again. And at that point, usually there would be some secondaries that had been found in her lungs or her bones, and the oncologist would prescribe a bit more chemotherapy. And I think she lost her hair 3 times over the course of the 10 years of her illness. She got used to wearing scarves, and occasionally she'd wear a wig, although she didn't like that too much. There were 3 very specific occasions I can remember when we called the elders and we anointed her and we prayed. And it's just interesting, but it seemed that each time we did that, that she would go for another 2 or 3 years of relatively good health. And that was the kindness of God, I think, yes, answering our prayers and perhaps using the medical system in that process. But they were very special times, very meaningful to us. And we had that calm assurance that whatever happened, that Debbie's life was in God's hand and that he was in absolute total control of the situation. And we would share that as a family, and we'd talk about that with our kids, and we would have prayer times and just try to use the situation to point, well, all of us, but our kids in particular, to the fact, you know, that, well, you know, this is something that we didn't ever ask for, you know, that God in his kindness, in his grace, has chosen to give to us, and he wanted us to trust him as we worked our way through all of that stuff. As I mentioned before, we had 6 kids at home. They were all at different stages in their lives. Our oldest boy was married during those years, and we had 1 grandchild before Debbie passed away, and so it was nice that she was able to taste a little bit of what life was like as a grandmother. In early 2009, we'd been in Brisbane for about 8 years, Debbie was driving back from Hervey Bay one day. She'd been up to visit her sister, who was a widow up there. And she was a little bit south of Gympie, and she started shaking uncontrollably in her left hand and on the left side of her face. She pulled over, she rang me and said, "What do I do?" And I said, "Well, just wait there for a little while, see if it settles down. If it doesn't, you'll have to call the ambulance." And anyway, it did settle down after about 10 minutes, and she rang me back and I said, "Well, keep driving, but sounds as though something's happening." Of course, when she got home, she had to have scans of her brain, and they discovered 2 large secondary tumours in her brain. And she was able to have some radium treatment to reduce the size of these tumours. The radium knocks you around a little bit for a while, but she recovered reasonably quickly from that. And so we said to the oncologist, would it be okay for us to go for a trip somewhere? And the oncologist said, no, it's too risky. I thought, oh, that's a bit of a blow. Then we spoke to the radiation oncologist, a different lady, a lady who was a little bit older, a bit more our age, got a second opinion. And we asked her the same question, and she paused for a long time. She looked at the ceiling, and then she said, if it was me, I'd go. And so we thought, we'll go. And within 3 weeks, we'd arranged to have a five-week overseas trip together. The kids were old enough to be able to look after the younger ones in the family, and with the help of our friends from church and neighbours and other family, extended family members, we were able to go off on this wonderful five-week trip to the UK and Europe. We'd never done anything like that before, so that was a trip of a lifetime for us. And apart from a little bit of tiredness at the end of long summer European days, Debbie remained quite healthy over that five-week period. A couple of months after we returned, she was out walking one day and her left leg gave way, and she had a slowly evolving stroke over the next couple of days, and she was in a coma in the Royal Brisbane Hospital for several days. Actually right over the time where our oldest son was graduating as a doctor. So she didn't get to go to his graduation, unfortunately. But after about a week, she started to improve. She was densely paralysed down the left side of her body, but she could still speak. And she then went into some palliative care for about a month, and they didn't know what to do with her because she was like a stroke patient and had reached a stage where she really needed to have extensive physiotherapy and occupational therapy and that sort of stuff. But they said she's got cancer, so she doesn't really qualify for stroke treatment. Anyway, we said to the palliative care specialist, can we take her home? We'll look after her home. We've got enough manpower and our big family to be able to. And that's what happened. And we had some modifications done at home. We took her home and we spent the next 7 months looking after her at home before she finally lapsed into a coma and then passed away. She wasn't quite 52 at that stage. I won't dwell on the details of the funeral, except to say that those days between when she died and the funeral service itself were extremely stressful. And if you've been there and done that, you'll know what I'm talking about. There's the grief, there's the exhaustion, there's all the planning that has to go in it. There's people coming and going and phones ringing, trying to work out details with an undertaker, trying to work out who's going to say what at the funeral. They were massive days, and yeah, they're a bit of a blur, really. But of course, it's something that has to happen. There were people at the funeral that I hadn't seen for years and years. How they heard about it, I don't know. I guess this is just the marvels of social media these days that makes those sorts of things happen. But I can tell you what, it was such a relief when it was all over. And thankfully there was some folk in the church who had a house on Stradbroke Island, and they said, go away for a week. And so I was able to take the three younger kids away, and we just slept and talked and hung out together and started the recovery process. I think probably the real grieving really only started, when we got away. As I mentioned before, the oldest son was married. The second son was working for the government. He was a town planner at that stage. The next son was an apprentice carpenter. And then the three younger ones were still at school. The baby was 11 by this stage, so he certainly did get to know his mother. I can still remember standing outside the Mater Hospital in Rockhampton holding him as a 13-month-old, wondering whether he would ever know his mother. Well, he certainly did, but he was 11. He was still in primary school at that stage. I had an awful lot of learning to do as a single father at that stage of my life. I'm not very domesticated, I'm very ashamed to admit. But by the grace of God, we were able to establish some new routines in our home and we got on with our lives. I think the kids all grieved in slightly different ways. Some were a little bit more open, talked a bit more freely. Others, you know, tended to keep things to themselves and I had to work a bit harder to get them going. But over time, we gradually developed some new normal sort of routines in our family life. It's now 13 years since we lost Debbie. After living in a house where once there were eight of us, I'm now living on my own. The two youngest kids have moved away in the last couple of years. One's working his way around Australia. And my daughter's a nurse back in Billawela. We've had three more weddings in the family since then. And the grandchild count has now risen to 13. And there's another one due before Christmas. So, I wonder sometimes whether Jesus tells Debbie that she's now got 13 grandchildren. I wouldn't be surprised if he does, actually. Yeah, just one of those funny questions that goes through your mind sometimes. I'm sure if she came back today that she would be encouraged to see the way things have been working out in our lives. All of them, praise God, are following the Lord, and I'm very thankful to have a good relationship with them. I have no greater joy than to those family occasions when we're all together. It doesn't happen very often now as a family getting a bit more scattered, but whether it's a family wedding or Christmas or some other special occasion, they're nice. Well, what are some of the things that God's been teaching me over these past, really it's over 23 years now since Debbie was first diagnosed? I've listed seven here. I'm just going to try and go through these quickly. The first is this, that the pain of grief is very real and it hurts a lot. Yet there's a sense in which you never get over the loss of somebody that you love. There's always going to be a hole in your life. Every day there's something important that is missing. There's somebody who's not there to talk with and to share with. There's somebody who's not there to go out with. There's somebody who's not there to laugh with or to cry with. And you just cannot avoid that. And so, you know, simple little cliches like you'll get over it or, you know, that's just not true. It's not true. And I think people who haven't gone through grief need to understand that. Yeah, we've got photos on our walls at home there, which I see every day, and they are reminders of something which is missing. But it's okay to grieve. It's okay to feel sad. It's okay when those memories come flooding back, you know, to feel that sense of loss. You know, death is a powerful reminder to us that we live in a world that is catastrophically damaged by sin. And only Christ can fix that. And death is, as I say, it's a reminder that things, you know, have been broken from the fall. And even as Christians, we're affected by the universal consequences of that sin. That's the first thing. The second thing is that there are no simple answers to the why questions. And I think it's perfectly natural to have those sorts of questions. Why did God allow this to happen? Why didn't God heal her? Why did he take her at such a young age, you know, such a strategic moment? I mean, those are sorts of questions which I guess, you know, it's okay to ask, but don't expect God to give you an answer to them. You know, God is God, and we're not. And we have no right to demand from God answers that he doesn't want to give to us, if I can sort of put it in that way. I mean, I don't know how much time you spend reading the book of Job, but I read the book of Job differently these days than what I did once upon a time. And, you know, Job has all these questions of God, and then you get to chapter 38 and God sits Job down. He said, Job, where were you when I put the stars in space? Where were you when I made the Leviathan and the crocodile, whatever it might be? You know nothing, Job. I know everything. I can do everything. And I want you to rest in me, to trust in me, and not to question me, not to sit me down as though I owe you answers to the questions that you want to ask. But God does it in a very gentle and a loving way. And I believe that that book of Job is so crucial for people who are going through grief and loss. God assured Job he was always in control. There was never a moment when he took his hand off the steering wheel of people's lives. The third thing is what we believe about God and suffering really matters. What we believe about God and suffering really matters. Because we live in a fallen world, suffering's an essential part of our lives. Do you really believe that? It's not simply bad luck when somebody is born with cerebral palsy. It's not simply bad luck when people get cancer or they get permanently paralysed as a result of a terrible car accident or something like that. Life is not random. Suffering is not random. Death is not random. You know, because of Debbie's death, I am more convinced than ever that God is absolutely sovereign. I'm more convinced than ever that life is not random, but that God is absolutely sovereign in all of the circumstances of our life. I often think of Isaiah chapter 55, verses 8 and 9. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Deuteronomy 29:29, the secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the things revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may follow all the words of this law. Faith means believing that God is good, that he knows what he's doing with our lives, and that even if we don't know what is going on, we can trust him because of who he is. And I think that is so important. Our theology really, really matters if we're going to be able to grieve effectively. The Bible is perfectly clear that suffering is going to be part of the journey of the Christian life. But it is one of the ways in which God helps us to grow in holiness. Often we quote Romans 8:28, don't we? We know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who are prepared to submit their lives and trust their lives to him. And if you read the next verse, the reason given is it so that we might conform even more to the image of his son, that we might become more and more and more like Jesus. This is God's purpose. And so, friends, if we really know these truths in our head, we have to believe them in our hearts, and we have to apply those, particularly when we're going through our darkest hours. The sovereignty of God is such a precious doctrine to me, and it's become more precious as a result of what I've been through. The fourth thing that I've learned is the question of divine healing can be very draining. The question of divine healing can be very draining. What we found was that there are very many well-meaning people among our family and our friends there who were desperately keen for Debbie to be healed miraculously. Desperately keen. And they had lots of words of advice and counsel for us. Even words from God, apparently. About how this healing was going to happen, all right? For some, a big enough faith was the key. If only you've got a big enough faith. For others, it was a bottle of oil from Benny Hinn Ministries that was sent to us. Yet another, there was an invitation to a front row seat at a Bill Johnson healing meeting. Bill Johnson from Bethel Ministries in the United States. That was an all-expenses-paid invitation. You've got to pay to go and hear Bill Johnson, apparently. I mean, I don't want to sound too disparaging. I mean, some of these people were relatives and close friends of ours, and they really, really wanted Debbie to be healed. But we were clear in our minds and our hearts about where God fitted into what was happening. We believed absolutely that God could heal her, no questions. And certainly we were praying for this. But we also knew that Debbie's life and her future were entirely in God's hands. I mean, as I mentioned before, there were three specific occasions when we followed James 5. And you know, as I said before, it seemed that when we prayed very specifically and intentionally like this, that God did extend Debbie's life, you know, in fairly significant ways. But towards the end of her life, there came a point, and it's a bit difficult for me to sort of really explain this clearly, but there came a point where both Debbie and I had a real sense of peace that what God was saying to us was, the time has come when I'm going to take her and it's going to be okay. You know, we kind of had that peaceful resignation that the fight was over. The battle with cancer was done. And it was as though God was saying, yes, I'm going to take Debbie, but I'm going to look after you, Murray. I'm going to look after the kids and it's going to be okay. And we were at peace with that. Debbie was at peace with it. I was at peace with it. We were able to say, we're not going to pray specifically now for God to heal Debbie. We're going to accept the fact that the Lord is going to take her. And God was very gentle with us. And it was very comforting really to come to this place kind of where we had this acceptance that God's will had become clear to us. It's interesting, you know, I've only sort of thought about this since, but, you know, when Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane and he was praying, Lord, please take this cup from me. And he prayed three very specific occasions, and eventually, you know, God said, I'm not going to take the cup away from you. I want you to drink it fully. And likewise, Paul, you know, when he had his thorn in the flesh, there were three specific occasions. We don't know how far apart those occasions were. But eventually there came to the point where God said, no, my grace is sufficient for you. Just rest in the fact that I'm going to give you whatever grace, measure of grace that you need to be able to endure what you've got to go through. You know, I think that there's a lot of confusion among Christians about divine healing, about the place of this so-called prayer of faith, about the supposed gift of healing, all right? And I'm sure that there is a gift of healing there, but, you know, I think there's also more to our understanding of what it really means to trust God in the midst of suffering. Maybe I'm still working that through in my own heart and mind, but I think it's very sad when there's a lot of emotional pressure that gets placed on people, and often there's some dodgy theology that sort of goes with it. Mm. Number five, God's love comes in many forms. If what I've said sounds a bit negative, let me say that many of our loved ones and our friends have been so wonderfully supportive, and they continue to be. I mean, we've experienced the very, very best of Christian love. You know, meals. We've had to say no more, no more. So many times, you know, a meal would come, but it would feed us for three meals, you know. Babysitters, cards and emails and letters of encouragement, phone calls, visits, financial gifts. We certainly knew that we were not alone. We were part of a much bigger caring family, and that's such a wonderful byproduct, I suppose, of being a Christian. Number six, heaven is now much more real to me. I know that the prospect of heaven is something that's in the back of every Christian's mind, and it should be. But going through, if I can put it, this might sound a little bit irreverent, but like 10 years of dying in slow motion, it does sharpen your mind on matters of eternity. You cannot avoid it. You know, I still today often think of what heaven must be like, and I'm very much looking forward to going there. I'm looking forward so much to being with Debbie again and seeing my mum and dad again and so many others who have gone before. I mean, that will be the ultimate healing. Revelation 21, I couldn't tell you the number of times I've read these words at a person's bedside. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There'll be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away." No cancer in heaven, no rheumatoid arthritis, no motor neurone disease, no quadriplegia. Everything will be made new. But even more, be no more sin, no more temptation. What do we say? Maranatha. Come, Lord Jesus, bring it on. I think, you know, the older we get, the more natural it is for us to think about heaven. But we don't just dream about heaven in some sort of poetic way. You know, we allow it to motivate us, to drive us onward, to prepare us, or to live our lives here and now, to prepare us even more for what is still to come. And I think as we think about heaven, let's allow it to motivate us to run even harder the race that God has marked out for us here and now, and to keep pressing on and persevering in that. Towards the end of her life, Debbie had such a vivid sense of identification with Paul in Philippians chapter 1, where he had this dilemma. He says, "Look, I really want to go and be with Christ, but there's still more work that I want to be doing here for the Lord. Oh, you know, I'm confused." You know, and I mean, I think that's the way it ought to be. Yes, we want to be with Christ. That's better by far, but it may well be, you know, there's still more that he has for us to do for him here and now as we prepare ourselves for that day. And then finally, I could say a lot more, but this is the last one. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is God's faithfulness. And that's the story of my life, particularly over these last 13 years, that God's mercies have continued to be new to us every morning. We decided very early on that after Debbie died, that she wouldn't be the elephant in the room in our family. We consciously talked about her, and we still do. So often, you know, when we're all together and the conversation is flowing, we'll say, you know, remember that time when Mum did this or that? Or if Mum was here, she would have done it this way, or she would have, whatever it might be. Yeah. But, we've got plenty of photos there to remind us of a special part that she played in our lives. And, I think without doubt I have lost something from my pastoral ministry because Debbie's not here. She was a great pastor's wife, and I highly valued her wisdom, her perspective on things, particularly when it came to women's ministry, women's things. Throughout our marriage, we hosted and led a Bible study group in our home, I think pretty well every year of our 27 years of marriage. We used to do pre-marriage counselling together. We used to do some other types of counselling together. Hospitality was a gift of hers. I mean, I really miss these things. I think on the positive side, I think I'm probably better able to identify with people who are suffering now. I'm sure that my understanding of the biblical teaching around suffering hasn't changed. But what I once knew in theory, I now know in personal experience. And I think that's added a deeper dimension to the pastoral side of my ministry. But life does move on. And as I said before, God's been very good to us. I mean, I still wish that she was here. I wish that we could grow old together. But God knows, and he's got his reasons. And a day is coming, might even be soon, you know, when we're going to be together again. Until that day comes, we just rest in his love. And I can say that the very best friend, the best partner in life is Christ. And he has been more than enough for me personally and for our family. I've been proving that. I continue to prove it on a day-by-day basis. And whatever lies ahead, I want to continue to make my life count for him. So that's kind of my testimony. Mm.